Chapter 46. More Trials. By the law of opposites, after the truth of man had been demonstrated, the postulate of error must appear. Mary Baker Eddy, 1885. The good news was spreading far and wide, and according to the law of opposites, reaction was setting in. In reality, there is no such law, but it seems to operate in human experience until we truly have but one God. Mrs. Eddy had first met up with it in Kennedy's malpractice against her, and now it seemed to be operating in all areas. A notice in the journal stating that schools claiming to be auxiliaries of the Massachusetts Metaphysical College were bogus was followed by another in the February issue, implying that Mind Cure, published in Chicago, was plagiarism from Science and Health. Swartz's activities were not unlike those of Arendt's, but they were accompanied by an assault of another nature on another front, a barrage from the Boston clergy. This was led off by the renowned Professor Townsend, who challenged Mrs. Eddy's healing ability and offered her $1,000 to give sight to one born blind. She countered in the February journal, "To reward his liberality, I offer him $3,000 if he will heal one simple case of opium eating where the patient is very low and taking morphine powder in its most concentrated form at the rate of 1 ounce in 2 weeks and has taken it 20 years and cure that habit in 3 days, leaving the patient well. I cured precisely such a case in 1869. Also, Charles M. Howe of Boston, formerly partner of George T. Brown, pharmacist, number 5 Beacon Street, will tell you that he was my student in December 1884, and before leaving the class, took a patient thoroughly addicted to the use of opium. If she went without it 24 hours, would have delirium, and cured her perfectly of this habit in 48 hours with no bad results and decided improvement in health. Ironically, while some Bostonians were applauding Townsend's attacks, others were eyewitnesses to Mrs. Eddy's continued healing work on the occasional Sundays when she occupied the pulpit at Hawthorne Hall. Emma Hopkins wrote, "There is no professional practitioner in the field of mental healing doing so many, so marvelous and instantaneous cures as Mrs. M.B.G. Eddy. Not a Sabbath preaching of the word of life, but loses the bonds of some poor sick or crippled prisoners. One which came under our observation after the sermon of January 18 was that of a man who went into Hawthorne Hall on crutches, but the power of the truth as she gave it utterance set him free from infirmities, and he went home without his crutches." By the beginning of 1885, Emma Hopkins had her office and residence at the college, and Mrs. Janet Coleman was out on the frontier, working for the cause in Chicago, moving on 2 or 3 months later to Wichita, Kansas. Mrs. Coleman and 4 other students from Chicago were among the 8 students in Mrs. Eddy's second normal class on February 16th. They, as well as all earnest workers, were stung by the next attack on their teacher. Boston was the center of culture. Tremont Temple was the most fashionable center in Boston, and Reverend Joseph Cook's Monday lectures, one of Tremont Temple's most popular and influential occasions. On Monday, the 23rd of February, Mr. Cook read a letter from his platform by Reverend A.J. Gordon, which pertained to Mrs. Eddy and Christian Science. Among other unkind things he read, "I believe Christian Science to be of precisely the same lineage as spiritualism, or theosophy, from beneath and not from above. One has only to open the published volumes of its Lady Apostle in this city to find such a creed of pantheism as has been rarely compounded." Opening a volume is all that Joseph Cook could have done prior to his bitter denunciation, having borrowed Science and Health from a student the day before and having heeded not the earnest request to meet with its author. While the hostility of these critics was sharp and shallow, the wounds it inflicted were deep and cutting. The leader responded with a defense of Christian Science and a request to answer the charges from the same platform. The day before this request was grudgingly granted, she preached a stirring sermon to her church. The journal reported, "March 15th, the Reverend Mary B. G. Eddy preached a powerful and awakening sermon from the text. Quote, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." End quote. Many new converts were added to the faith, and the deep abiding interest of all was strengthened by the reassuring words of the faithful messenger of the second coming. She was calling for a Peter, a rock, who would uphold her understanding of man. For 14 years, she had had a Judas to contend with, and now the Judas concept seemed ubiquitous. Where were the Peters? They did not come forth in her experience at Tremont Temple the next day. She came unto her own, and her own received her not. The world could not know how she suffered from this encounter, but Julia Bartlett knew and has given us an inkling. She was reluctantly granted 10 minutes in which to meet all their false accusations with explanations of the truth of Christian Science. It was a hard ordeal for her to encounter this hatred and antagonism to truth. And when the time came, I rode in the carriage with her to the temple. When we reached there, we were met by Joseph Cook, who was very abusive and insulting in his remarks to her. But she made no reply and took her place on the platform. The large house was filled when she rose to speak, and the time was short. But her work was completed, and she stopped at the end of the 10 minutes allotted her, although she had not consulted her watch. As we were leaving, I heard some say, "She is a wonderful woman." We rode quietly home. I saw she must be left to herself, and her help came from a higher than human source. When we reached home, she went to her room where she remained alone. I thought if I could only have shared some of the burdens, how gladly I would have done it. And if the world only understood, these trials would not have been put upon her. No one but herself could know the burdens of that hour. At another time, she expressed it in these words, quote, "Never, never will a mortal again drink my cup," end quote. Mrs. Eddy knew what Jesus had suffered, for she spent 40 years on the cross. Those long years included triumphs as well as tragedy. But Monday, March 16th, 1885, was a day of crucifixion. It was for her as she had written of Jesus. The burden of that hour was terrible beyond human conception. The distrust of mortal minds, disbelieving the purpose of his mission, was a million times sharper than the thorns which pierced his flesh. The world did not understand, but Julia Bartlett did, and did what she could. The previous Christmas, a few students had invited their teacher into her reception room, where their gifts to her were displayed. She turned almost immediately to Julia Bartlett and said, "I thought it was a picture." Julia, who was keeping a secret, replied, "I do not see why you should think it was a picture." "Well, I did," said Mrs. Eddy. Miss Bartlett then stated that there was a picture, but that it was not ready. "I thought so," Mrs. Eddy responded, and added that there had been a most beautiful, awe-inspiring picture of Jesus in her student's thought whenever she had seen her of late, and it seemed to have a history. The fact was that Miss Bartlett had a cherished picture of Jesus with a face beyond any she had seen in the most ideal renditions, which was said to be copied from the portrait carved on an emerald by order of Tiberius Caesar. This she was having copied for her leader, but it was not completed. In March, the portrait was finished, but Miss Bartlett had not yet made the presentation. This sad day, after the Tremont Temple experience, seemed to be the proper time. However, Julia would not disturb her leader and had to leave for a church meeting, so she asked another student to present it in her name when Mrs. Eddy returned from supper. Mrs. Eddy was so affected by it that she wished to see me at once and sent this student for me. When I met dear, dear Mrs. Eddy, she was deeply moved and expressed her love and gratitude and joy. I could not say all that this picture brought to her thought of the real Christ Jesus as one who had suffered and triumphed over all claims of evil. But she at once rose above it, and I rejoiced with her. The picture meant far more than Miss Bartlett ever knew. It was a symbol of her loyalty. Quote, "The real cross, which Jesus and Mary Baker Eddy bore up the hill of grief, was the world's hatred of truth and love," end quote. This gift of love from one loyal heart dispelled the gloom of the world's hatred that day. The numerous gifts that the leader received were all symbols to her, and she read in those symbols the thought of the donor. The cost in dollars was irrelevant, but the cost in giving was of utmost importance. Her card of thanks in the January journal is interesting to consider. Daily obligations, a large correspondence, school in session, all pressing their demands on my time. May apologize for one public expression to you all. My heartfelt thanks for your rare Christmas presents. From such a constellation of beautiful things, I can name only the central figures. From this constellation of gifts, she then named a few, but note that she did not say a few, but rather only the central figures. Among elaborate gifts, why should she name pocket handkerchiefs? Was it not because she could distinguish the widow's mite? The thing of itself meant nothing. The thought behind it was all. This listing of Christmas gifts continued for several years, and perhaps a few students learned from it. Those who had given of their earthly wealth and received no recognition may have been chastened or angered, but if they had given only of earthly wealth, their gift measured not at all in the scales of God. A gift from Mrs. Eddy on giving weighs mightily for all mankind, for all time. Who doth but give me of his earthly wealth, gives to me that which cannot reach the heart, and may but serve to stir my neighbor's envy, while he who gives me just a simple thought of life or truth or love gives to me that which I may give again, yet have and keep and use throughout eternity. Julia Bartlett's gift had reached the heart. Emma Hopkins was also giving of herself to the cause. Right after studying, she had written, quote, "I lay my whole life and all my talents, little or great, to this work," end quote. One of Mrs. Hopkins' first contributions to the journal had been entitled God's Omnipresence, in which she praised the truth in all places, from the Buddhist Nirvana to Zend Avesta of the Persians. The danger that lay in this path and in the path of all intellectual pursuits was not yet seen, and Mrs. Hopkins was daily applying her many talents to Christian Science work. She wrote feelingly in the March journal, "Never but once in the history of man was persecution so malignant and curses so causeless as those heaped against the scientists of today, who fain would ask for which of their good works the Boston clerical mob stoneth them." As always, the leader was the one to meet the problem and lead the way. By March, she had published 2 pamphlets for the protection of her babe and her cause. The first was a booklet of 21 pages entitled Historical Sketch of Metaphysical Healing, which sold for 10 cents. The second pamphlet, which also sold for 10 cents, or $1 per dozen, was a reprint of an article in the March Journal by Mrs. Eddy, entitled Defense of Christian Science Against Reverend Joseph Cook and Dr. A.J. Gordon's Religious Ban. One sentence from this 16-page publication has solved many a problem for many of the woman's children. A human sense of love sees no farther than to die for a friend. But divine love includes its enemies, and love so great destroys hate, blessing itself in blessing its enemies. In April, the Christian Science Journal, with its changed name, had a new format. It was beginning its third year, and it was growing up. In its new dress, it was still filled with refutations of false charges by pulpit and press, including Mrs. Eddy's answer to Professor Townsend and her brief speech at Tremont Temple. In another month, she had risen above the storm clouds. The lead article in the May Journal was Love by Mary Baker G. Eddy. What a word! I am in awe before it. Over what worlds of worlds it hath range and is sovereign. Sometimes this gentle evangel comes to burst the pent-up storm of error with one mighty thunderbolt and clears the moral atmosphere, foul with human exhalations. It is a born blessing at all times, either as a rebuke or benediction. The persecution, though difficult, had some beneficent effects. This letter from a stranger represented a portion of the public's reaction. I had not known of the new metaphysical medical practice till I read of it in the interesting letters of Professor L. T. Townsend, published in Zion's Herald last winter. I mean to try Christian Science for my own infirmities, just from the information furnished by the contemptuous letters of Professor T. Please send me some printed pamphlets or works on the subject, if there are any. An article by a Boston reporter in the summer of 1885 also shed a ray of light. Lillian Whiting of the Traveler wrote, "Here in Boston, we are so accustomed to hearing of the marvels of the mind cure that we fail to really learn as much of its mysteries as people often do from a distance. And pondering all these things in my heart one day, I resolved to go and see Mrs. Eddy, the originator of Christian Science, popularly known as Mind Cure. Now of this, I am neither a disciple nor a scoffer. In view of what I am about to relate, I beg to preface that I went to Mrs. Eddy with no positive feeling either way of either conviction or skepticism. I had never even seen a mind curer, never heard one of their lectures, and had not read extensively of their literature, when I suddenly resolved to call upon Mrs. Eddy if she would permit me to do so. My note of inquiry was met by a very courteous invitation to come to her at an hour named, and accordingly at 8 o'clock on that evening, I rang the bell of the large and handsome residence on Columbus Avenue, known as the Metaphysical College. A maid ushered me into a daintily furnished reception room, where pictures and bric-a-brac indicated refinement and taste. Presently, Mrs. Eddy came in and greeted me with a manner that, while cordial and graceful, was also something more, and had in it an indefinable element of harmony and a peace that was not mere repose, but more like exaltation. It was subtle and indefinable. However, and I did not think of it especially at the time, although I felt it. Mrs. Eddy impressed me as a woman who is, in the language of our Methodist friends, filled with the Spirit. It seems to be a merely natural gift with her. She is by nature a harmonizer. My own personal experience in that call was so singular that I will venture to relate it. I went, as I have already said, in a journalistic spirit. I had no belief or disbelief, and the idea of getting any personal benefit from the call, save matter for press use, never occurred to me. But I remembered afterward how extremely tired I was as I walked rather wearily and languidly up the steps to Mrs. Eddy's door. I came away as a little child, friend of mine expressively says, skipping. I was at least a mile from the Hotel Vendôme, and I walked home feeling as if I were treading on air. My sleep that night was the rest of Elysium. If I had been caught up into paradise, it could hardly have been a more wonderful renewal. All the next day, this exalted state continued. I can hardly describe it. It was simply the most marvelous elasticity of mind and body. In the evening, I had callers, and I told of my visit to Mrs. Eddy, and later, chanced to allude to the unusual and indeed utterly unprecedented buoyancy and energy I was feeling. "Why, that's the result of your going to Mrs. Eddy," exclaimed a friend. I had not thought of it before, because, you see, I went to have my mind stored, not cured. And in the journalistic sense, I forgot I was with the most famous mind curer of the day. Miss Whiting had only one half hour of the woman's attention. The world had had her love and devotion for nearly 20 years, as she held uncomplaining guard for humanity, and the effects were far-reaching. As the Boston clergy raged against her, she had made it known that she would teach clergymen gratuitously. Though her defamers scorned the munificent gift, other clergymen did avail themselves of this opportunity of a lifetime, nay, of an age, and the more spiritual among them were greatly blessed and benefited. Even though the woman was deeply wounded by clerical attacks and hostile public opinion, she was never deceived as to the real enemy. The real danger to her teaching was not the open warfare, but the silent, secret attacks upon her students to destroy her and her mission in their minds. In her historical sketch of metaphysical healing, she had written, "13 years I have watched with critical acumen the effects of the subversion of truth by a mental malpractice. There is but one right way to deal with sin, namely, if you cannot stop it, to expose it for the safety of others." In the effort to protect her students, she warned them of these secret attacks and their effects, and she published this warning in her historical sketch for her students in time to come. "Duty demands a word of instruction from me on the unscrupulous methods of mental malpractice to stay the progress of those entering the path as metaphysical healers or Christian scientists. If, as I understand it, my father has shown me the way in mental science, he has also shown me this awful abuse of it, that I may forewarn and forearm the age. The following is the mental modus of crime: to produce physical sufferings, family discords, losses in business, inability to heal yourself and others, etc. If these tortures fail to discourage the honest mental healers, the next attempt is to make them believe that mesmerism, alias mental malpractice, had nothing to do with their experience, and that Mrs. Eddy had scared them on this question to the result of producing it. If they can deceive you into believing this, it deprives you of understanding enough of the question for self-defense and leaves you in their power, relieved of suffering and rejoicing in freedom. If they cannot produce this blindness, their next step is to beg a quarrel between you and Mrs. Eddy. No matter how great your obligations or how highly you have had reason to respect her, you will hate her more or less. This abnormal effect is your proof that it is mesmerism, alias mental malpractice. Without cause, you will then drop all intercourse with her. Give her no opportunity to see you or to defend herself. Now you are ready for their next step: to make you suffer over again and believe that Mrs. Eddy or some of her students are causing it. This finishes the program. They have covered their own crimes now, and you are in their power without knowing it, and cannot progress in metaphysical healing. The modus operandi of malpractice against the Christian Scientist is not greatly different almost a century later. 1. Problems and the inability to heal oneself and others, which produces discouragement. 2. The belief that malicious mental malpractice has nothing to do with these experiences, and one need give it no thought at all, which produces a false sense of freedom, which is blindness to malicious mind. 3. The separation of Mrs. Eddy from her discovery, and eventually from the student, either consciously through rejection or unconsciously through neglect, or most subtly of all, through denial of personality. If malicious mind can make the student see Mrs. Eddy as personality rather than as the woman of the apocalypse, that will choke out appreciation and gratitude, and will separate the discoverer from her discovery in his consciousness. 4. Renewed suffering and inability to progress in metaphysical healing. Under the title Malicious Mesmerism, the experience of a student was published in the journal for May 1885. I had safely and delightedly closed a course of instruction under Mrs. Eddy at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College, Boston. All enthusiasm and hope, I set forth on my mission as a healer, but had hardly taken my first case when an unaccountable fear of my teacher took possession of me. Why was it? She had ever shown me the kindliest attentions, and certainly no mother could have discovered the characteristics and capabilities of her child more correctly than she had mine, or more gently led her along an untried way than in her wisdom she endeavored to lead me. But all to no purpose. The fear of her continued and developed further into a fear of everybody else. Further still, into fear of the very sunlight, for I dreaded each morning, bringing with it the memory that I was a scientist. Over and over again, the loving sisters of the association advised me to hold possession of myself against this mesmeric effect, as I had been instructed on the question of malicious mesmerism. Nonsense, I said. It's my own self that is wrong. Nobody can mesmerize me. Finally, one sister, in pure commiseration of my state, took it up for me to set me free from the darkness and fear that seemed overpowering me. Suddenly, my heart lightened. Life seemed again a pleasant thing, and hope dawned where despair had held sway. Since that effort was made in my behalf, and on that ground, I have never despaired, and my veneration and love for my teacher in divine science increase daily. This student was saved, but the efforts of malicious mind to separate the students from the revelator diversified and intensified, and to this day it has not stopped.